Okay, so hi everyone. I'm sitting with Dr. Jennifer Heise, the director of NeuroFit Lab at McMaster University, but also the author of Move the Body, Heal the Mind. What an amazing read so far, and what an honor to sit down with you today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I just wanted, before I even get into the questions, I've started reading the book. I'm not even halfway there yet, but I've enjoyed the book so much. And one thing that I just wanted to bring up, and I appreciate it, you doing in this book, is how you break it down. Someone with a science background or without a science background, anybody can understand it and understand the physiological benefits and the mental benefits of just moving your body. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Well, that was on purpose, right? Because I wanted people of all different backgrounds to be able to understand how important exercise is for the mind and the brain. And I think we don't often think about exercise as a therapeutic for the brain or the mind. And by exposing or understanding more of the science, like the fundamentals, the biology behind it, it can really start to give it some concrete evidence that maybe people will value it more. So that was part of the goal, but I also wanted my mom to understand it. So I wrote it in a way that she would get it too.
And you did a great job. So I want to start off with a little bit of your story. And I know you talk about that a little bit in your book, but please, I would love to hear how it shapes what you do personally and professionally.
Yeah. So it is quite a personal journey that I've been on and a professional one. So it happened back when I was in my 20s. I was in grad school and I was studying cognitive neuroscience. So how does the brain represent memories and who we are? And it became really clear to me that something wasn't quite right with my own brain. I was having some pretty severe anxiety, some intrusive thoughts that turned out to be OCD symptoms. And I went to the doctor and they prescribed an antidepressant, and I just was really reluctant to take it. And so on a whim, I borrowed my friend's rusty old road bike, and much to my amazement, those bike rides really soothed my mind. They quieted my mind, and it gave me a profound sense of peace that I hadn't had in such a long time. And so that just not only sparked a shift in my personal life, because before that I was a little bit active, but not really. And it became a central focus for my health and my life, right? So that was a big shift, but also in my professional life. So the profound effect that movement had on my own brain wanted me to know more about the effects, the research, how this was working. And so I shifted the focus of my research just away from just the basics to how does exercise change and alter the brain to support cognition and mental health. And that's what we do in my NeuroFit lab here at McMaster.
I love that. And a portion that you talk about also in your book is how you've done the Ironman race. Crazy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So especially not being an athlete, something like that seemed totally out of scope for me, but it sure enough, I did do it. And it all started, I mean, it's the thread, it's the personal thread and journey that follows the book, right, from beginning to end. And the book starts with a pretty difficult transition in my own life. Unfortunately, my marriage had ended, and I was really looking for something to give me some positive motivation to rebuild the strength of both my body and mind. And so I thought, okay, maybe I'll try a triathlon. This was something new for me. I'd never put swimming, biking, and running together before. And so I thought, okay, I'll try a try. And so that was in 2017. And, I trained for the sport, built the strength for my body and mind. I was able to, kind of transition into my new life. And then in that summer, I tried the try, which, these are low key, super low key, But nonetheless, I ended up winning a silver medal, which was like, so, but I was just like, okay, this is my sport. And so, I stuck with it and I kept doing kind of each year I would do a longer and longer race. On this journey, I got the idea to do the book and thought, oh, it'd be so fun to track my progress through this sport, the impact it was having on my own brain and mind, and tell the science. And so that's how it kind of came to be. And I was like, okay, it's got to end with this heroic completion of the full Ironman, one of the most grueling endurance races of all. And so I was gearing up for it. In the best shape of my life, March 2020. And everybody knows what happens. The pandemic pretty much canceled the world. Gyms were closed, pools closed. My race got canceled. And so I was like left in this lurch. You know, I'd been on this 3-year journey. And so now what? How was I going to like end my book? It's not as if I could say, yeah, they canceled the race, so I just didn't do it.
I went home.
not really the inspiring ending I was going for. And so I decided to organize my own race. My family and friends were at every aid station. Can you imagine how awesome that was? And then it was grueling, and probably even more grueling because I did it on my own, but I did do it. And I think it makes for a really great ending to the book. And it just, to me, you know, now looking back, it does really showcase, you know, all the resiliency that exercise can give. And that is a really strong message that I wanted to convey in the book.
I love that. First of all, to run the Ironman, run, swim, bike the Ironman. It's like, it's a whole series, right? There's a certain kilometers that you have to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which is incredible. and you mentioned that you weren't an athlete earlier too.
Mm-hmm.
And so was it the bike ride that kind of like put all this in action, or was it something before?
Yeah, it was the biking was able to build up my fitness. Like biking is pretty easy. It can be pretty easy and it's fun, right? So I was able to build up my fitness, and then I started running because you need to be, you know, running is more difficult, more vigorous. So you need more fitness. And so I gradually added running, and then the swimming came later, and that was something I had always done as a kid, but I had left it as a child and revisited it again after my dad passed away, as sort of a tribute to him. And so I took swimming lessons. I conquered this like swimming fear I had, and then swimming became like kind of that last piece. But and then putting it all together for the triathlon was really fun. But holy smokes, it was grueling. It took me 13 hours and 10 minutes straight to do the whole thing, and like it was a day of like rain and hot, and trees were down on the trail. Like it was an epic day, but. I'm so glad I did it. And in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, well, it's for the people reading the book, you know, you need to show them, you know, you need to do it for them. And so that it really did keep me motivated.
Wow. Insane. That's insane. And I think that there's nobody better to talk about the benefits of exercise and how it helped you through the different kind of arenas in your life. So I want to get started and ask you the relation between brain health and exercise. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that in your book. It's a very fascinating explanation that you provide, and I'd love for other people to hear it. So tell us more about the exercise and movement, how that can impact our brain on a pathophysiological level, and by extension, how do these changes impact our mental health?
Okay. Well, there's so many amazing things that exercise does that impacts the brain. So kind of there's sort of three fundamental things that it does. The first is sort of it increases oxygenated blood flow to the brain, which helps the brain cells need to function and thrive. So that's number one. Number two is that when we contract our muscles, our exercising muscles will release chemicals into the blood that move to the brain, cross the blood-brain barrier, and stimulate a bunch of processes and activate processes there. But then exercise also stimulates the release of neurochemicals directly within the brain. And so it has this real profound effect on the brain. Some things that people may be familiar with, endorphins are released by exercising when we're exercising hard, and endorphins are one of the body's natural pain relief, you know, natural painkillers. And so endorphins are released in the body to help soothe our aching muscles, but they're also released in the brain, and this can help stimulate the reward system to make the exercising motivating. Endocannabinoids are kind of part and parcel there too, which is the body's natural form of cannabis, and that's released when we exercise, that released through the body, and that molecule is small enough to cross the blood-brain barrier, and again, it goes to the reward center, activates the reward, and releases dopamine to help motivate and feel good. And so when endorphins and endocannabinoids meet at the reward system and co-activate it, it can create this real hedonic pleasure, which we get from runner's high. So that's pretty exciting. Exercise also releases this resiliency factor called neuropeptide Y. And neuropeptide Y is, it seems to protect the brain from trauma. So war vets who have gone to war, some of them will come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, but not everyone will. And the ones who are protected seem to have more of this neuropeptide Y in their brain. And we can make more neuropeptide Y with light to moderate exercise, which is really amazing. Wow. Mm-hmm. And then I could go on and on about this, you know, adrenaline or epinephrine, norepinephrine stimulates the prefrontal cortex to help us focus. And then the whole connection between inflammation and the brain, we can get into that, and its link with depression if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us more about that.
Okay, sure. So, one in three people who have depressive symptoms and take antidepressants don't actually respond to the medication. And this is probably surprising to a lot of people that, you know, you're taking your medication and it's not relieving your symptoms, like you're still depressed. And it turns out that typically the antidepressant drugs are serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, and they target serotonin, right? So they help to increase the bioavailability of serotonin in the synapse. But for some people with depression, this is not their problem. You know, their brain is producing enough serotonin and that's okay. What their problem is something else. So the root cause of their depression is something else. And it's actually, for a lot of people, likely inflammation. So we know inflammation from the immune system, right? It's the body's natural response to an infection or a pathogen in the body. And inflammation helps us to fight off that infection and restore the body back to health. And so when we're sick with a cold or a flu, we have elevated inflammation in our body, and that can elevate in the brain too, causing some so-called sickness behaviors. So what does that look like? Well, it looks like you alone at home in bed watching Netflix. That's what I'm like. You know, you're low mood, you're antisocial, you know, and I like to think of it as the brain's natural form of social distancing, where it isolates you from the rest of people to prevent the spread of infection. And so inflammation can have a direct impact on your mood. But with sickness, you know, our body typically will heal within a week or two. And so once the inflammation reduces, these symptoms go away and we're back to being our happy self again. But what can happen with chronic illness or chronic stress is that there can be an elevated immune response for weeks, months, even years, and this can cause depressive symptoms and the sickness behavior for much longer. So the elevated inflammation within the brain then starts to look a lot like major depressive disorder. However, because the root cause of this mood disorder is inflammation, it's not going to respond as well to SSRI drugs because we're not getting at the, we're not using an anti-inflammatory to fix the problem, right? So this is where exercise comes in, and it is the medicine that these individuals who are have drug-resistant and depression need. And the reason being is because exercise is anti-inflammatory. So an acute bout will increase inflammation, but immediately after you stop exercising, the muscles release all these myokines, which they clean up all that inflammation and then some, so that the more regularly you exercise, the less inflamed your body becomes. And so once you start reducing that systemic inflammation throughout the body and the brain, then you can help restore not just your physical health, but your mental health and well-being too. And so this is a really amazing benefit that exercise has. And research that's looked at the benefit of exercise for people with major depressive disorders see clinically significant, meaningful reduction in their symptoms that's on par with antidepressant drugs, which is amazing.
On par.
Like, it's technically a tie. And so I think my hope with this book is that we start, you know, bringing in exercise into the conversation, like alongside, it can be alongside antidepressant use because they can be transformative for a lot of people who take them, right? But even for people who have, you know, who respond to antidepressant drugs and get relief, they can use exercise as an add-on therapy to help reduce their side effects and also to even help reduce their dosage that they might need to feel good. And so I see exercise as the medicine that we all need, because it has such a profound effect on the brain and our mood, and in particular regulating how we feel and our depressive levels.
Love that. You said it so comprehensively. But I love the information that you gave about NPY, neuropeptide Y, mm-hmm. and what the effects can have on the body and the brain. And I know you also touched on the mental health aspect of it. And so this is kind of a question, this comes from a personal level, but somebody who, or at least in the exercise world too, I've always heard that if you're not sweating really hard, or if you're not doing HIIT workouts, you know, it's not really exercise. Or sometimes, you know, I feel a little guilty, you know, if I go for a little lower impact of a workout like yoga. Does that actually have neurobiological benefits? It doesn't matter which type of exercise it does. Do the intensities matter?
Mm-hmm. No. Well, so this is the beautiful thing with using exercise, or what I like to call it is movement, because that seems more inclusive than exercise. Like, we have these like negative connotations about what exercise is, right? It's like you go to the gym for an hour. That's exercise. Whereas movement can be so much more dynamic and inclusive. And like, it can be dancing, it can be gardening, it can be taking the stairs, it can be going for a walk, it can be, it can be a lot of different things that may resonate better with people, right? Especially if you're not active and you're not an athlete and you don't see yourself in sports. Exercise is still something that we all need, and we need to start incorporating it into our life. So the amazing thing with exercise for mental health is that the research shows that every single step counts. So some is better than none. This is the bottom line. And this is true for reducing depression, improving academic performance, you know. It really is, some is better than none. And so this idea that you have to go out all intensive and do a HIIT workout is not true. In fact, when we look at like a meta-analysis that combined all the research on depression, when they look at aerobic exercise, for example, it doesn't have to do with intensity. It has more to do with duration. So the longer that you exercise, every 10 minutes that you exercise more, you get an additional benefit in your depressive symptoms. So, and it didn't matter which intensity you were working at. So light to moderate can do too. So like a self-paced walk would be equally beneficial, or your yoga class would be equally beneficial. Now that said, when we look at resistance exercises, intensity does seem to matter. So the more heavier that you're lifting, so you know, if we compare yoga, that's not super resistive, like a light yoga or Tai Chi, versus more intensive resistance exercise where we're lifting weights or using resistance bands, it's the weight bearing exercising that has the bigger benefit, at least for depression and for sleep, we found in our research. So, but with aerobic exercise, the duration seems to be important.
Interesting. That was so interesting. And this is something that I've also kind of read about. I know I follow Dr. Mark Hyman as well. And so he's also one of the great thought leaders on this whole, research leaders on all of this. But he also mentions, and I've heard this even from other people, but often, like when you think about exercise, we can make it so reductionist, like you said, right? Like we just look at the amount of calories that we've burned on our watches and we're like, ah, oh, damn, like I've only burned like 80 calories from my yoga, but really it's not about that. And that's what you really illustrate in your book. And even in this podcast here, you're saying that there exercise in general has a multitude of benefits.
Yes, yes. And in fact, at the start of the pandemic, we conducted a survey, to sort of get the pulse of people, you know, how are you feeling? Are you able to be active? What's changed? And I mean, not surprisingly, anxiety, stress, depression were all up, activity was down, but people shifted why they wanted to work out. So they wanted to work out instead of to look good, they wanted to work out to feel good. But what we found was there was a bit of a paradox. So their mental health, they wanted to work out for their mental health, but their mental health was getting in the way. And so they were too stressed or anxious to do it, and they lacked the motivation to do it. So I think an important caveat when we think about using movement to heal our minds is that we need a totally different approach. It needs to be super compassionate. We need to be focusing on this mantra, some is better than none, every step counts, you know, and moving in ways that make us feel good. You know, needs to be a supportive way that we're caring for ourselves, you know? And so I think, that's an important piece to mention, and an important thing to, maybe it's a mindset shift, you know, like it's certainly just reconceptualizing how we think and see exercise and incorporating it in our life in a way that makes sense for us. You know, it's like a very individual thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said it the best. It's almost like a mindset shift from moving away from seeing exercise as a chore and instead seeing it as kind of like a form of self-love, really. So
yes, absolutely. And this is something that for me, it's every day, you know, a little bit of movement every day. I'm not training for an Ironman now, but for example, this morning, I try not to have too many meetings in the morning so I can do my workout, you know, and I have the time and space because I know that that's the medicine I need. You know, certainly it's still hard for me to get my butt off the couch some days, but the focus is really on, no, this is your care. You know, you'll feel good. It makes you a better person. And this is, you know, this is what your body and mind need.
Yes, absolutely. Tell me, and this is another thing that you mentioned in your book, how exercise is so connected to sleep. I was very surprised about this one.
Okay. Yeah. And this is kind of a cool, the connection's super cool. So there are two ways that exercise helps promote sleep. And one is it's around the more we move during the day, the better we sleep at night. This is sort of the bottom line. But the reason why this works, I think, is just so fascinating. So it comes back to ATP. So the energy currency of the cell, right? So ATP breaks down when we use our cellular energy, and the more we move during the day, the more ATP we burn. But the byproduct of ATP is adenosine. And as we burn our ATP, we build up adenosine, and adenosine starts to accumulate throughout the day. And there's sensors within the brain, receptors in the brain, that bind to adenosine, and that is a natural sleep aid. It triggers sleep. And so we can build up more adenosine with exercise. So we're burning more ATP. So there's this direct link between the energy used and the sleepiness we feel. Exercise is also, it can act like a, you know, a circadian regulator. So it, you know, we think of the sun as a way that we can help regulate our sleep-wake cycle, but we can also use exercise in the same way. So our brain, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, has this clock, and it's timing is actually linked to the transcription factor. So the genetic transcription of proteins that happen throughout a 24-hour cycle. However, the brain, these transcription factors are not precise. It's not 24 hours on the dot. It's on average 24.2 hours. So it runs a little bit late. Yeah. And so every morning we have to reset it so that it like resets back to like, okay, the real time. So brain time can match real time. And so this, we usually use the sun to reset that, and that works through melatonin, but we can use exercise in the same way. So exercising at the same time every day is a really strong chrono marker that the brain can use to reset its brain time. So exercising at the same time outside in the sun every day would be a fantastic way to, if you're finding your sleep-wake cycles getting out of sync. Sometimes I find that like I like to stay up late, so I'll like it sometimes shifts late and late and late and late. I'm like, oh my gosh, I gotta start waking up a bit earlier. Then exercising in the morning first thing outside in the sun is a fantastic way to help reset the clock.
Interesting. I did not know that. Is there a certain time of the day that is beneficial to exercise in general, or does it really matter? Like it depends on the circumstance.
Well, I guess there's two answers here. So first of all, you get your movement in whenever you can. So, I mean, back to that idea, some is better than none. So don't overly stress yourself about getting it in. So for some people, it works better in the morning. Some people it works better in the evening. Whatever works with your schedule, I would say. But there are ways that we can, you know, if you want to wake up earlier, morning or early afternoon exercise helps shift the clock that way. You know, it's like a daylight saving shift. And then if you work out in the evening, that can help you stay up a bit later. And so if you want to tweak your chronotype or your chrono clock, then you can do it that way. But generally, it's good to exercise when you can most conveniently fit it in to your schedule, right? There is a lot of talk about, oh, you shouldn't exercise before bed.
Yeah, now, heard a lot of that.
Right? But the research actually isn't really that convincing on it. There's been one study to show that it could be detrimental. But in that study, they had the participants run vigorously just before bed. Like it was like less than an hour before bed. And their heart rate was still elevated by the time they hit the pillow. And so when the heart rate, I think it was elevated about 25 beats per minute above baseline. And it took them about 14 minutes longer to fall asleep. And so if you're exercising so vigorously just before bed that your heart rate doesn't have enough time to come down, then maybe that could delay your sleep a little bit. That's sort of that's the evidence around exercise before bed. But if you're well trained, your heart rate might come down quicker, or if you're working out like at a light or moderate intensity, then it wouldn't have a big impact on your heart rate. So yeah, we can kind of think of it, it's like analogous to like, you know, when you go to bed anxious,
yes,
and anxiety, you know, races your heart. And so when your heart is racing from anxious thoughts, it's harder, it takes longer to fall asleep, right? It can take an hour. And so it's that same analogy there.
Yeah, like the elevated heart rate, you're in a sympathetic mode almost.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. And so I love what you've offered on sleep and exercise. And another section, and this was a, this was another section in your book, which I thought was like one of my favorites, was the idea of how exercise can help restore hope as we move through difficult transitions in our life. And I love that because in a very difficult part of my life, I used exercise to help cope with a lot of the stress that came with the pandemic, came with like, you know, not being able to go to the gym, but still finding other ways to move, going on a walk or, you know, doing something at home, you know, low resistance. So when we're going through a lot, maybe we're stressed, anxious, seemingly in uncontrollable situations, how can exercise help us manage those external experiences that we're having?
Yeah. So, this is, to me, this is the most beautiful gift exercise gives, is this, this sort of reprieve from stress immediately after the workout. So when we do a workout, it doesn't matter what intensity, like I said, the muscles will start releasing neurochemicals. These neurochemicals will end up in the brain. And one of them is called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is a growth factor. It's one of many of the growth factors released from exercise. And when brain, it's BDNF, when that gets into the brain, it reports to the brain region of the hippocampus, which a lot of people know related to memory and Alzheimer's disease. It's the brain region that's devastated by that disease. And so when BDNF gets to the hippocampus, it promotes growth of newborn brain cells, helps support the function and survival of those cells. But a lot of people may not realize that the hippocampus is also involved in shutting off the stress system. And so when we're under chronic stress situations, like we have been with the pandemic, it starts to damage the cells there in the hippocampus. They start to shrivel and retract. And so the brain can't shut off the stress system as effectively. But when BDNF is there, it helps to restore that function, almost like protecting those cells against the damaging effects of stress, so that the brain can start shutting off the stress response, not just for exercise stress, but for all stressors in our life. And so there's this, we have to think about it, like our stress system, there's only one stress system for all stressors. And when we use, we can use exercise to help turn that on and turn it off, but it's done in a very controllable way, right? So when we exercise at a moderate to vigorous, it's on. But then once we stop exercising, the stress system turns off. But it just doesn't turn off for exercise stress. It turns off for all stressors in our life. And so we have this moment of peace, reprieve, solace, and then the hope can start to bud from there. That in that's my experience, is that, you know, you can almost, you know, the glimmer of light, the reminder of who, you know, the hope that was once there, and you can see a way out, you know, it's just a nice moment. And I mean, you mentioned yoga earlier, but in yoga, they really try to cultivate that, right? With the shavasana at the end. But I mean, we really should be cultivating that in every form of movement that we make, because there, that it's there, you know, and we just need to acknowledge and recognize it. And when we do that, you know, it brings a mindfulness to it, that can help restore the hope that we may have lost because of the, you know, the uncertainty, the stressfulness, the uncontrollability that some situations, including the pandemic, have presented and will, you know, this is life, you know, it's not all roses, unfortunately. And we need to have these strategies and tactics to help us cope through these difficult transitions. And exercise can be a really helpful tool to do that.
Yeah, I love that you've shared that, because it's not something, you know, when I think about when I'm stressed out, it's not something I automatically think about as well. Exercise isn't the first thing my mind goes to, really. My first thing is, how can I lay on the couch and, you know, shut off these negative feelings, and, you know, not have to think about them, maybe like numb it, watch TV or eat something. I'm an emotional eater. So
yeah.
But I love that you're sharing that that exercise can also be a resiliency factor. It can be a healthy coping strategy when we're feeling out of control.
And yeah, and just a point here, because we only have one stress system for all stressors, when we're feeling stressed out or in those moments of like darkness and turning to exercise, sometimes we may not be able to push our bodies as intensely as we normally can because we already have like the baseline stress is up, and then we add exercise stress on top of that, we may not be able to tolerate as much total stress load. And so this is where the light to moderate exercise can be beneficial. And even that intensity of exercise is enough to increase BDNF in the brain to help, you know, start soothing and, you know, revitalizing the brain cells within the stress off switch to help re-engage and bring some peace.
Love that. A quick question for you, because we were talking about the BDNF, does that just act on the hippocampus or can it also act on different parts of the brain? Mm-hmm.
It does act on different parts of the brain. It's heavily concentrated in the hippocampus, but it also works on different parts, including the prefrontal cortex, which is like the CEO of the brain. It does all the executive functions. And when the prefrontal cortex is working optimally, we can, you know, we can focus, but we can also be really creative. We can make good decisions. We can have more regulation over our emotional brain, which is really a lot of that, those negative thoughts and fears that we have are dominated by the amygdala, which is our threat detection center. And so when the prefrontal cortex is working optimally, it can send sort of calming messages to the amygdala to sort of soothe it and calm it down. And actually, like, so exercise helps to re-engage it, but so does mindfulness. So when we practice mindfulness meditation, one way mechanism through which that works is it allows the prefrontal cortex to calm the amygdala down. And part of that is like, we need to get out of our head and into our body. And that's one way that exercise really helps that. I mean, in meditation and mindfulness, they often talk about paying attention to your breath, right?
Yes.
As a way to stop thinking, focusing on thoughts and kind of concretize your experience in the moment. But we can do that with exercise too, quite naturally. You know, breath rate will speed up, or maybe it's a self-paced walk and you just want to focus inward and onto the breath, and that can be incorporated really nicely. I do talk about ways that we can do that in the book too, with the wellness walk or the mindful movement breaks. And I think that's a really important piece when we're using movement to heal the mind.
Yeah, very actionable in your book as well. Some of the, and exercise and mindfulness, they share so many common like ideas and principles and benefits. And so it's interesting that you mentioned how, yeah, when you're exercising, you're focused on the body to help heal the mind. Meditation, it's using your breath as an anchor to help, you know, heal your mind. But there's so much research that exists around this. And I know that you also go into this in your book, but how come, why is it that it's so hard for us to exercise? Because, oh, I think about every workout that I have to go into, and I often find myself dreading it a little bit. But every time I come out of it, I'm like, I can't believe I was like, you know, second guessing whether I should go in or not.
That's it. I mean, that's the thing. And it happens to me. I'm like 30 minutes on the couch for my 30 minute workout to just talk myself into it.
Literally.
And so this is not our fault. This is actually, we can blame the brain for this. Yeah, there we go. The brain, it's actually a relic of our evolutionary past. So if we think about what happened, you know, our early ancestors had to expend a lot of energy to hunt and gather their food to survive, right? And so when they weren't moving to survive, they needed to conserve energy. And so essentially the brain makes us lazy. And if we flash forward to now, we don't really have to move to survive, at least not in the moment. And so the brain sees voluntary exercise as an extravagant expense, and it sort of works its way to try to talk you out of it. Oh, do we have time to do that? We don't have any energy. Aren't you too tired?
Too much.
Yeah, they're so, it's rebuttals are relentless, right? And so this is part of the problem, why it's so hard and will continue to be hard for the rest of our life as we try to maintain a fit life. But you're right. As soon as you start moving, what happens is that the movement itself becomes very rewarding and motivating, and in and of itself starts to reinforce itself. So you just have to start. It's that first step. It's like up off the couch to the door is the hardest part, right? And then once you start moving, the momentum will just carry you, because that's when all the neurochemicals are released in the brain to help reinforce the behavior. But there are some things you can do to help ease, you know, the transition from couch to movement.
Yes, tell us about those.
Yeah, so like the first thing is, this is just so simple, but this is my go-to. You have to plan ahead, and not just blocking it off in your calendar, which is really helpful, sort of having a plan of when you're going to do it and reserving that time for yourself, but also having the details worked out. So what are you going to do, when, where, with whom? And the reason that's really helpful to do ahead of time is because making all those decisions on the fly actually will drain our willpower and kind of take away the self-regulation willpower we need to exercise. And so it becomes even harder to kind of move the body up off the couch and out the door. So that's number one. Another really go-to for me is, like, you know, having music playing to kind of get your, you know, when we listen to music that we enjoy, it can help stimulate dopamine within the reward system, which can help sort of get us motivated and feeling good. And so that's a key. One of the key things is either listening to music, working out with friends can be really motivational. Yeah. And these, like, close ties with others, you know, this having accountability buddy is really helpful. And then probably one of the funniest ones from the literature is, like, this swish and spit technique. But yeah, it sounds gross, but it's, like, actually pretty funny. So because the brain is, like, it's like paranoid that resources are scarce, right? And it's sort of programmed, hardwired to think that. By swishing some sugary drink, like a sports drink, like Gatorade, Powerade, whatever, in your mouth, and then you actually don't have to consume it. You just swish it in your mouth for a few seconds and spit it out. This is enough to, like, remind the lazy brain, you know, that resources are plenty. It's okay to move. And in fact, the research shows that just doing this swish and spit makes the movement, especially at the beginning of the workout, feel less effortful. So whoa, there you go. Lots of fun tips.
I was going to say, that is so interesting. So you just swish a sugary drink in your mouth. Wow. And so it tells the brain that you have enough resources. That's what you're saying.
I think that's how the mechanism must be working, is this idea that it's, like, reassuring. Yeah. Okay. We're good. We can go.
Move forward. I love that. Oh my goodness. Thank you for sharing these three. And what I find interesting is that even with the planning ahead, if I notice myself going, like, if I know that I have to work out, if I'm going to the gym, it seems a lot easier because I have it planned. I know what to do. Like, it's a very automatic process, versus if I know that I'm going to be working out at home on that day, it's like, okay, now I need to find the workout. Now I need to set my mat down, get, like, it's just, it feels almost harder if it's not planned.
Yes. And I was finding this during the pandemic too. Like, be like, okay, well, I'll, like, do it at the end of the day. And then it was like, you know, you just, like, stuff happens. And then it's like, oh, I'm tired. And you don't have the context of, like, working out with others, which is, even if you're not working out with them, just the presence of them in the room can be really motivating. I really miss that. I was certainly missing the incidental social connections that come with movement, and And so I'm so happy we're back to it.
I know. It's been a long time, long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've loved these tips that you've shared. You've shared some actionable things. You've shared the pathophysiology of it all. And it's just been so, so interesting. Dr. Jennifer Heiss, if we want to get in touch with you, if we want to connect with you, get your book, I will have everything linked in the show notes, but tell us how we can find you.
Sure. Okay. So yeah, my book is called Move the Body, Heal the Mind, and it is available anywhere you can buy books. You could follow me on Twitter at Jennifer Heiss, H-E-I-S-Z. I'm on Instagram at dr.jenniferheiss. I have a website, jenniferheiss.com. And this actually, I put some videos from the solo Ironman. There's some backstory there. And it's kind of a neat resource if you want to check it out, or you can go to my lab website, which is neurofitlab.ca. So there's lots of ways to connect and lots of information to learn. We're actively doing research in this area, so there's so much still to uncover, especially around the mechanism and the pathophysiology. And so stay tuned for more research.
I love it. And I'm so excited to see what more you kind of put out, the research that you're doing. And we're not done yet. I have 6 questions for you. They're a quick rapid fire.
Oh, whoa.
I do this with everybody that I usually have on my podcast. And what it is really is I ask you a question and you give me the answer in one line or less.
Okay.
But I didn't send these to you in advance.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
I'm ready.
Okay, perfect. First question for you. The title of my podcast is Mind Over Matter. So what does putting mind over matter mean to you?
Putting mind over matter means realizing you're more capable than you probably think you are.
Ooh, nice. I love that. Something you've done recently, or listened to or read that's inspired you?
I'm a huge fan of going to the symphony, and the Hamilton Philharmonic played the 4 Seasons from Argentina. And I just have to go to Argentina now. Wow. Because the music and the rhythm was so motivating, so invigorating. So I'll go with that one.
Are you a classical music fan?
I love classical music. Yes.
Me too. Love that. It's your last day on earth. Who would you want to spend it with? It can be anyone.
Oh, my daughter, Monica. She's my dream. She's my sweetie. Yeah.
Love that. What has been your silver lining of the pandemic?
My silver lining. Okay. Well, my partner lives in Montreal, and during the pandemic, he was able to live with me in Hamilton, which was really, really special and usually wouldn't have been possible.
That's so nice. So, so nice. And I guess this one, I may or may not have led you on in this one, but who is one person that you admire in your life and why? It can be a coach, mentor, family member.
What, just one person?
Just one person.
Oh gosh.
I know it's hard.
I don't know. There's so many people. Like, I'm thinking my mom, my dad. Yeah. Probably one of them. I'll go with my dad because he's passed, and we'll honor him in this way. But he worked so hard from very little education, very little money, and created an amazing life for my family and for me, and so many amazing opportunities that I'm just so grateful for. And he started with very little, you know, and you can grow an empire. And I think that that's just such a beautiful, you know, reminder that anything is possible.
That's really heartfelt. Thank you for sharing. Mm-hmm. And last and final question for you. What is your favorite song?
Oh,
yeah.
What's my favorite song? Maybe, what am I listening to lately? Like Stevie Wonder. You are the sunshine of my
life. Love that. Stevie Wonder. Favorite artist for you?
Favorite artist?
Is he your favorite artist?
I'm into him right now. I don't know if I have a favorite artist. I'm like one of those people that, like, you know, what do I need right now in my life? And then it just varies. So there's so many inspiring people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today. What an absolute honor.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much, and take care.
Thank you. You too.